Hello, hello, hello. I think we're live. Welcome to Woo! Patreon Q&A 43. How you doing, Mr. Torres?
I am fantastic. Just had my second shot.
Ooh.
So, yeah.
Starting the drinking early today. Oh, no.
Yeah. No, I got Pfizer number two, and so therefore I'm drinking LaCroix.
Pfizer buddies. Yeah, Pfizer is great. That's awesome. Congratulations on that. I hear you not as loud as me. Let me know. I don't have control of Andrew's volume. Let me know if that's just a me thing or if that's also an Andrew thing. Either way. I'm excited to do another Q&A.
I'm always excited to do a Q&A. I love doing it.
Yeah. Let's see. Anything to talk about before we start? We got a lot of awful movies in the, editing bay for you. Can't wait. We did a little early, so I can work harder editing this 2+ hour monstrosity. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Does everyone know? Yeah. Look, the gun show was early. If you're not in at 6 o'clock, you missed that. But if you're here at 6:01, you can learn that we did the Trial of the Chicago Seven with one Heath Enright. So that was a lot of fun.
Well, why don't we get started? I wonder who has the first question. I better it could be anybody.
It could be any one of our thousands
of patrons. Could be any of them. Let's figure it out. Here it goes. Hey, it's somebody named Teresa Gomez. Andrew, tell us about your dad's chili story. So I think that means you have to tell us about it. Don't tell the story, but tell us about the story. Okay. It must be the question. I think that's what she's getting at. But I don't tell the story, otherwise you won't be answering your question.
I think Teresa is used to me having a liberal interpretation of her questions. Yeah. So,
I'm an originalist textualist. It says, tell us about the story. It doesn't say, tell us the story. The founders would have wanted it this way.
That's true. So, here's about the story. My dad, and this actually will answer the question both as intended and in Thomas's interpretation. So my dad called me up. This was like 8 or 9 years ago. And you need to know, like, I grew up in a household eating spicy foods, right? Like, and I mean, my dad challenged me from a very young age. And like, you know, we went to his favorite chili parlor back in Springfield, Illinois, where he grew up, and his name is on the wall from, like, you know, 1971, having won a contest of eating a bowl of their firebrand chili. Like, it was,
I'll never understand why people do this to themselves. I love hot food.
So that's what we grew up with, like spicier, hotter, whatever. My dad calls me up like 10 years ago and says, I'm mailing you via FedEx a bowl of chili. And I want you to eat the chili. And then I want you to call me because I have a story. And so I said, all right, cool. And then the next day, like a big block of frozen chili came and I heated it up. And I made myself a nice big bowl of chili. And
I like to imagine that when he mailed it, it was already in a bowl with a spoon in it, you know, just like ready to go. It wasn't
I took a bite of the chili and it was delicious. It was also the hottest fucking thing I've ever eaten. So I literally ate that bite and then I went and I know everybody in the comments is going to be like, you need to drink milk or buttermilk or heavy cream. Look, I didn't want to totally kill the spice, right? So I ate the bite of chili and then I drank a beer, an entire beer down to try and just get cold liquid in my mouth. And then I ate a second bite of chili and then I drank a second beer. and I proceeded this way for about 8 bites of chili. Like it was amazingly good, but like it did not get easier to eat. Like it was still incendiary at every level. And so finally I was, you know, 8 or 9 bites of chili and a corresponding number of beers in. And so I called my dad and I was like, all right, Dad, like this is tasty, but like, did you like lose a bet or something? And my dad was explaining how he cooked the chili. And he said, look, so I just got the pot together and I, you know, put in the cube pieces of steak and the spices and everything. And I threw in one ghost chili, right? And I was like, I've got that. I'm going to see what it's like. And then I took a bite, right, of the broth, a sip of the broth. And it, you know, it had a little bit of spice to it, but not enough. So I threw in some more chilies. And then I took another sip of the broth and I was like, this doesn't have any heat in it. I don't understand. So I did this like 5 or 6 times and just kept adding like more and more chilies. And finally, like I was just about to give up. And then I went up to go to the bathroom and I looked in the mirror as I went into the bathroom and my tongue was just blistered white. And so what had happened was the first time he took the bite, he lost his sense of taste. And so kept adding in chilies after that and developed what was essentially liquid napalm with kidney beans. It was delicious. It was really, really good. And I love my dad. Today is also my sister Carla's birthday. So
you're all crazy. I don't know. Toxic masculinity. You don't need to do this to yourselves, everybody. I never understand because they always talk about it as a cultural thing. You know, like, oh, you're so white if you don't eat spice. I like a little bit of spice here and there. But like, do other cultures not have heartburn? Because I have heartburn real bad. So I can't do this to myself. I don't know. I'm on horse size heartburn medication. Looks like Andrew dropped out or something. He's been having these issues lately. I'm not sure. Well, that's way too zoomed in on me. I don't like that at all. Here, can I change it? No, that's not good either. How about this? Well, we'll wait till the captain gets back. Can't really answer. Well, did anybody ask anything for me? Probably not. Why would anyone ask anything for me? Let's see.
I have.
Oh, he's already back.
Okay. I have no idea.
Okay, you're back. No, that's the wrong one. Nope, that's the wrong one. There we go.
It just kicked me out of the stream, and I have no idea why the hell it did. But StreamYard just did a like. You're no longer connected to the stream. Anyway, sorry, I'm back.
Okay. Let's see. There was a good, this one has 32 hearts. I appreciate you patrons for hearting the questions you want to hear. It helps me pick them. And this one, this is a lot, 32. That could be a new record. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Finally got back into my account, asks, how ridiculous can I get with requirements in my will? Can I make my grandkids stay in my haunted mansion for a night?
So that actually is a lead-in to a segment that I have planned. Ooh. It is on the whiteboard. It is the single most pointless act of studying for the bar that lawyers do. So I would like to do like a July
beyond episode. You mean even more pointless than when they study separation of church and state because it doesn't matter anymore.
right
doesn't matter.
you memorize, and I have alluded to this before, this is often considered the hardest part of studying for the bar, but you have to memorize this thing called the rule against perpetuities. And the rule against perpetuities controls how much your dead hand can devise property to your heirs and assigns, right? So it's super complicated. It's real property, so it starts off complicated. And this is legendarily like the most complicated thing in real property. So you know it's extra special. And I was hoping to do an episode on that as a shout out and in solidarity with you know, our listeners who are taking the bar. But yeah, it's a crazy spider web of shit you can do. And like, depending on how you put particular words, like you can accomplish things that if you put the words in a different place, you wouldn't be able to accomplish, right? But like, for example, I can control property literally forever, right? Super simply. I can say, when I die, I want my house to go to Thomas so long as he uses the basement as an opening arguments museum. Cool. then you get my house, and you know, you can pass it on to your kids and their grandkids, and that clause stays operative. And so 800 years from now, if somebody stops using it as an opening arguments museum, it will revert to my line.
I was going to say, so there's no way to get rid of that opening arguments museum. Like, is this a way to like enshrine us into the history books forever?
It's why people do that. So, yeah.
I have a question. Like, what if your house wasn't haunted? How do you get it haunted? I want to know if there's like, the question was sort of like my haunted, like you need to make it haunted. I wonder if you, do you leave out like ghost food and then you check like, do any ghosts, ghost money? I don't know what you would do. What if no one had ever died or in your house or something and you need it to be haunted? It'd be an interesting process. Okay. Another question here. Fun fact, 9 cases of shoe polish labeled as hair color were seized in the Giuliani raid, asks, is the raid, very on-brand question, is the raid on Rudy's office and home really bad news for him and also for Trump?
Yeah, we talk about this unsurprisingly on tomorrow's cleanup on aisle 45, as you might suspect. But I'll give you a sneak peek at the answer. Like, oh yeah, it's real bad, right? And again, not because there is an explicitly higher standard here other than, you know, there's a taint team. But because implicitly, right, judges who grant warrants, search warrants, you know, only upon probable cause, right, there's a federal magistrate judge, that they're also lawyers. And so they have to be like super duper sure before they authorize it against a lawyer. I also want to add, I don't know, also talking about this, but like Alan Dershowitz went on Fox News to say the only reason to get a search warrant for a lawyer's office is if they're destroying evidence, spoliation. And like, even for Alan Dershowitz, that was a weird fucking thing to say. I mean, I just don't even know where he thinks that's coming from. Like, it's just made up. Like, there's no special rules for, like, what the Fourth Amendment does to a lawyer, even if it's a, you know, sweaty ex-Trump lawyer. So, there you go. Real bad news on Giuliani.
You know, I think you might be peaking now on the audio. So
I don't want that.
Yeah, you're doing such a good job staying close. That could just be me, but that's what it sounds like. All right.
I scrolled. I think we're not peaking. So, okay. But
another question with 14 hearts. Schmelkers asks, Biden failed to say the state of our union is strong. Does that, coupled with the gold fringe on the flag, mean our country is a corporation rather than a sovereign state? As such, do we get corporate treatment for our debt obligations, asking for a friend? Well, that wasn't a state of the union, right? Isn't that the whole deal?
There you go. Thomas answered it correctly. Yep.
The first one's a freebie, I get. Like, you don't, is it the logic that you haven't been president long enough to know if our union is strong? You're like, I don't know. I think it's strong. We'll see. Ask the last guy. And then after a year, you're like, the state of our union is strong.
Yeah.
Also, it's not very strong. We are cleaving apart rapidly, but just in a different way, maybe.
It will be interesting to hear the adjective that Biden picks in January of 2022, right? Like, because I suspect there will still be an awful lot of fucking work to do. And like, it's really hard to say we need massive, big scale, you know, projects, but also, you know, America's totally fine because I'm president. Like, that's a tough balance. The tone he took in that speech was, you know, we're on the move again, right? Which is sort of, that's a thing you can say after 100 days. It's kind of hard to say that after, you know, 400 days. So, so I'll be interested in that, but, it's never a bad time to say, like, I continue to be 99th percentile pleasantly surprised by the Biden administration. I say that as somebody who is significantly to Joe Biden's left, who, you know, I didn't vote for him, all of that. And I didn't like the fact that he ran as the most conservative Democrat. Like, it's hard to argue with just about anything that he's done so far. So,
yeah, well, but we're seeing a benefit of that. You know, I read, it was maybe the Daily Podcast, but something somebody said I found very interesting, which was Republicans are reacting to what Biden is doing now by saying, oh my God, lefty, progressive, blah, 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 as they always do, you know, socialist agenda, and people are surprised by it. But the funny thing was, everything that he's done was something that was a campaign promise. But because it's Joe Biden, all his campaign promises were treated with a attitude of like, ah, conservative, moderate, you know, he's moderate, he's almost a Republican, Joe Biden. And then now that he's actually doing them, it's like, oh my God, this is actually really progressive. And he was promising it the whole time, but Joe Biden has this Joe Biden effect of if he says it, we think it's moderate, which is good and bad. Like, obviously he is moderate on some issues, but the great benefit of that is he has a real opportunity to just make stuff mainstream by adopting it. Like, the minute he adopts it, then it's like, ah, it's a moderate Democrat view, even though it actually is really progressive in some cases. So I think there's an upside to that.
Yeah, I totally agree.
All right, this is a fun one. This is right up my alley. I'm currently rereading Lord of the Rings for the first time in a long time.
Oh.
And it's a delight. Toastmaker Tyson asks, I know you can't copyright words or language, but if you put enough of them together, you can create a copyrightable work. Now, what if the language I'm using is the invented language Elvish by J.R.R. Tolkien? Am I violating the Tolkien estate's copyright by writing an article about Mike Trout and Elvish? let's see. If yes, I'm going to try to wiggle back into fair use by instead writing a review article about the size of the Tolkien universe, and I'm using the invented language to further illustrate how unnecessarily large this universe is by writing about it using its own unnecessarily invented language. Unnecessarily? Oh, I disagree. I love the elven language in there. It really, really, the world building is my favorite part of Tolkien. It just really feels like a real place, you know? It's really, I think this is part of it, that work that he put into it. But anyway.
I mostly agree with that, although I'm telling you, like, the long pages of Elvish poetry are a challenge for my, like, linear brain to get through.
I think it's more the Silmarillion, right? Are you still on your Silmarillion?
Oh my God, yeah, the Silmarillion is still garbage, yeah. I hope Rachel's not in the chat. A couple things. First, if I haven't plugged it on a Q&A yet, you should read The Art of Language Invention. I forget the author, but just Google it. And it was written by the guy who created all of the languages for Game of Thrones, right? And it starts off with, like, he's got, like, you know, like, I have a I was 10, like, geeky law story. He's got an equivalent, like, Andrew origin story of, like, watching Star Wars, right? And the beginning of Star Wars, like, they're clearly, like, yeah, George Lucas was like, well, all right, make some nonsense syllables, right? Because, right, that, you know, when they're walking around, it's like, ka wik la roo, and then it's like, ka rik la roo, and they translate to two different things. And he's like, oh, come on. Even when I was 10, that was insulting. I'm sorry, puppy. I can't take you out right now. I am doing a Q&A. Puppy is under my desk nosing me with the, I need to go out, I need to go out, I need to go out. Anyway, back to the story. And so he got into, like, writing, like, creating an authentic alternate language, right? And so he's now, like, the go-to person for shows like Game of Thrones that are like, no, we want that level of verisimilitude. It's super interesting. So if you ask that question, you should read that book. Now, let me answer the law. When you create a copyrightable work, you have the right to create derivative works that come from that. And so what that means is, and again, this is on a case-by-case basis, like, you do not own all of the words that are present in your work, but you own characters that you've created in that work. However, you don't own what are called scenes à faire, which is, I think, Latin, like nobody owns, it was a dark and stormy night and the dame walked in and she was legs all the way up to her neck, right? Like, you know, nobody owns, you know, film noir.
Nobody should own that.
but But so well, but that's how
you, you can mean like have, genre kind of.
Yeah, well, scenes of fare is meant more narrowly. It's like like tropes, like things that are so you know, for example, I mean, that's why you can that, like that's why D&D can have orcs in it, right? But I suspect the Elvish language, assuming that they have the proper copyrights and have successfully like renewed those copyrights, I suspect that if you wrote a book in all Elvish, that would be something that you would, you know, that would be considered a derivative work of Tolkien's works, and you would have to license the right to use Elvish in the same way that when you see like the Klingon cookbook, like they're paying royalties to the
Klingons,
Star Trek.
To the Klingon Empire.
To the Klingon Empire. Gah!
To the delightful Klingon cooks who gave us those recipes.
Yes. Hats off
to them.
Since it is May the 4th, I will proudly stake that I am a Star Trek over Star Wars day.
I don't know how to evaluate that, actually. Yeah, no, I guess I am. I don't know. Yeah, I guess. I don't think a lot about Star Trek. I think more about Star Wars in my everyday life. But I guess if I had to think about it, Star Trek is probably a superior product overall. Anyway, that's interesting. So I guess maybe, you can't, if they've maintained those copyrights, that you can't write a book in Elvish without paying them.
I'll tell you a book that kind of crosses that skirts the line is it's a work of alternate history the author's not coming to me. He did, maybe it's not Kim Stanley Robinson, and he wrote about an alternate history in which and then there was a future history associated with it. But basically, like, the laws of physics suddenly change and like internal combustion doesn't work. Right. Like it just. And so it's a way of like instantly forcing the world into, you know, a Middle Ages level of technology that they can't ever get out of, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can't ever do better than
that's super,
you know,
cool.
Yeah, it's a really neat idea. And he wrote a bunch of books that, so it's like a contemporary fantasy set in a, you know, the decaying ruins of civilization, and one of the factions explicitly is like, oh well, like if all of a sudden, you know, we're stuck in, you know, permanent Middle Ages, then like, fuck it, like we're gonna be elves, like we're just gonna they communicate in the Elvish language in the book, but it is explicitly because they're like, yeah, well, we stole this from Tolkien, like,
oh, interesting.
So and that, I think, you know, because it's a reference and an homage and not, you know, and not a derivative work, like manages to evade copyright law. But I love this kind of stuff. I am planning, assuming that it works and I can get it through, I have a really fun copyright law segment for next Tuesday's show that involves, among other things, Transformers. So
of course it does.
Cool. So I'm looking forward to that. Okay.
All right. Let's get on to our next question by Reality is Getting Stranger by the Day. If a cop is recorded likely committing a crime, but the state does not pursue it, is there some version of a mandamus order that can be sought to force an investigation? Interesting.
Nope. So you get a writ of mandamus, or as we call it on the show, a writ of Matt Damon. That is the Latin root for mandate. When you have an indisputable right to compel a government official to do a thing, and the only way that you get an indisputable right is when it says
no discretion.
Yeah, the government must do X, and so you know, prosecutorial discretion is kind of the archetype of where you have that. I will add, it is rarely pursued. For example, one of the things where I thought And it was very clear to me that the House of Representatives had standing to get a writ of mandamus back when the Ukraine investigation broke, and they chose to go to their impeachment anyway. I had some criticisms of how that impeachment was waged, and one of them was, right, it was very clear under the statute that the IG, it says, you know, must turn over the complaint and all supporting data within 14 days. And not only did the DNI not, you know, he went to Bill Barr instead, which sort of kicked off the whole thing. But they never sent over the supporting data. And to me, I thought, yeah, go get yourself some Matt Damon on that. But they decided not to.
Yeah, I mean, this person is looking for recourse, I think. And the idea is it's hard for the state to be judge, jury, and executioner for itself. And what can we do? And I guess the only option is some sort of election something real to, you know, vote in different prosecutor.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Like when you're talking about most crimes that cops commit, those are state level crimes, and most city and state prosecutors are elected. So you have a political recourse. You can also attempt to legislate additional consequences. But at the end of the day, if the prosecutor declines to charge somebody, there's not a whole lot that you can do. And Meg Jackson, yes, he did. That's another one of our inside
jokes. What is
jokes,
that reference? So. Now I'm blanking on what show that's from. Is that from Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
Oh, I thought you made it up. But
no, yeah. I didn't make it up. It's from a show. I can't remember what one. But
I was willing to give you just
every
enough
time
credit.
I say there's always people who think that I think that's what it is, and I love it's funny to me every time. Some people must think I'm really dumb. That's okay.
Before you do, but Morally Gray Podcast says, who does Andrew like better, Megatron or Galvatron? That's super easy. It's Megatron, but there is the episode Web World is the best counter argument for Galvatron. So anyway, there you go.
I just blacked out for a minute. What happened? I don't
know. We're back.
Anyone
have
any Magic the Gathering questions for me? No, it's okay. I like it. We both have it's Hot Fuzz. Yeah. Oh, even better. Have you seen Hot Fuzz, Andrew?
I have not.
Oh my God. Hot Fuzz is a great movie. You should
watch Hot Fuzz?
Okay. Did you watch what's the zombie one? Somebody tell me. What the hell is the zombie one? It's been so long now.
I have no hell? Idea.
Anyway, there's a name. What is it? Somebody in the chat will tell me in a sec. Anyway, it's what's his name, and they do fantastic movies. Hot Fuzz is one of them. Shaun of the Dead. That's it. Have you seen Shaun of the Dead?
No.
Okay. Well, you're missing a branch of good movies. They're very good, so you should check them out.
Okay.
Okay. Daniel the Vegetarian Blacksmith Sullivan asks, I love messing with scammers that call me. Like today when they did the car in your name found with 10 pounds of drugs scam, I went on a rant about someone stealing the other 20 pounds. what if any are the limits of how much I can do to them on the phone/computer?
Don't take legal advice from a podcast. No, that's pretty funny. It's a stage play now, and I'm trying to remember what it's called. And I want to say it's like the Nigerian phone scam, but, and it is just, dramatic enactments of a guy who like stayed on the line with, you know, the guys running the like actual Nigerian prince scam, for like 2 years, got them to send him like, you know, $117 to like this one account, right? Like I remember taking a look at it and it seemed like it was pretty funny to me. I'm gonna riff for a sec, because obviously I'm not gonna answer the question, right? I do not want to be called from jail and have Daniel the Vegetarian go, well, I followed your advice and here I am. about 6 or 7 years ago, my brother-in-law had a friend who was terrified, right? Had gotten a like notice in the mail, and he's like, oh my gosh, you know, they're coming to collect this horrible debt. What are my legal rights? And, you know, and, you know, and so Sean was like, my brother-in-law, Sean was like, well, let's talk to Andrew and right over. And it was what I looked at, like the paper that they sent him was like, it had the seal of the Supreme Court at the top, right? Like, look, the Supreme Court.
Wow, the Supreme Court's in on this debt, huh?
Is it on this debt?
It went all the way up to the Supreme Court without your knowing.
The Supreme Court without you knowing, yeah.
Who's the other side of the case that if it's not you? Has somebody else been fighting on your behalf?
And so, like, if you looked at it for a second, like, I looked at it for a second, and then, like, what went through my head was, gosh, if I had zero ethics or morals, I could invest. This scheme is working, and like the fact that it's being, you know, promulgated to folks indicates that it's worked on somebody. Like I could do better than this in you know, in my sleep, right? Not like have the header be the IRS, right? Like you know, have the sentences, yeah. Use proper grammar, yeah. Right? Like, I mean, you know, and ultimately, like, we figured out on the basis of it that this guy worked for my brother-in-law and had gotten a payday loan at some point, right? Like, you know, when was in an emergency, and that was then when I realized that, oh yeah, well, like, probably one of the big ways in which payday loan scammers also make a shit ton of money is you're now on a list of the kind of sucker who would get a payday loan. And look, like, let's be clear about that. That is incredibly oppressive, right? Like, it is, you know, the burden falls disproportionately on, you know, people who can't pay their bills. And we should be mad at, like, payday loan scammers. And, like, but so it was clear to me that it was the payday loan that had gotten his name on a list and then, you know, was eventually sold to, like, Nigerian scammers. And I asked him, like, how often do you get, like, obvious scam material? And he was like, well, a lot. I was like, well, this is one of them.
Yeah. But, gosh. I mean, yeah. There's a lot to talk about with those scams. Oh, it's also all roads lead to depressing stuff because people have tried to track them down. And then you end up in countries where there's like houses full of people doing them that have no money. And you're just like, who's the bad guy here? Is it capitalism? I don't know. But also there was one that was actually I'm sure someone else has come across this. Back when I worked at my first job out of college as an accountant, there it turned out, and I would love to take credit for this, but I don't think I was the one who figured it out, or at least maybe. Anyway, when I started working there, we got a bill for this is a really creative scam that people do for businesses, and I think it's pretty effective because they take like, okay, here's a some sort of information requirement that you have for your business. Like what I can't remember exactly what it was, you know, post your business name with the Secretary of State for some, whatever it is. And then they take that and they send you an invoice as though like, here's the fee to do that. But the way they skirt the line and it's not actually illegal is they do provide you like a copy of the thing, you know, and they kind of insert themselves in a way that you don't need, but that when they send the letter, it seems like you do. So it looks like an invoice, you know, it looks like, there's another fee I got to pay for what running a business or whatever. I wish I remembered more details, but it's been like 12 years. But anyway, they had been paying it for like 5 years. And I think it might have been, I don't think it was me. I think it was actually my boss who had also started like just before me to try to get the place under control was like, this is a scam. We've been paying this for 5 years.
The things you get as a business owner, it is, I mean, I'm surprised I don't get more of these questions from my clients. I hope that they're not paying them, but like, so yeah. For example, right. In April of last year, I got a thing, you know, on an officially looking piece of letterhead that was basically like, here's how I can pay, you know, $119 for a sign to post in my workplace about, like, you know, warning people about COVID protocols, right? Like, and you really had to look into it. Was not, you know, it was technically legitimate because if you looked in the fine enough print, it was like, you know, what we're doing is, you know, we're doing you a favor by giving you a laminated sign that has the the laws on it. And like, oh, God. And it is just so – I really feel bad for people who have, like, started a business and, like, don't have a lawyer and, you know, you get these pieces of paper and you're like,
I think the message is just don't pay anything, like, ever. Don't take business advice from a me. But, like, honestly, most legitimate stuff that you have to pay – you can, like,
you get a second notice.
Yeah, you get a second notice that, like, or you'll get a call, you know. My favorite though is the call that your social security number has been canceled or whatever. Isn't that what they say? It's been canceled. Ah, no. I just want to be like, oh, weird. Oh, well, I guess I don't have one now. I now don't have one. All right, let's get back to our questions. Drew Vogel asks, can we pretty please have OA500, the hardcore history of eminent domain? I will up my donation to a dollar amount equal to the number of hours in the run length of the episode. Wow. You don't want to do that.
Oh.
Yeah. A 500. I still don't know what we're going to do, if anything. Probably just do an episode, but, you know, that's a lot of episodes.
I'm really excited that we are coming up on our quincentennial. Wow. But yeah, now that believe me, that's a possibility.
All right. Sparkle Donkey Tequila is doubling down on support for the Trevor Project. Great organization. Donate at thetrevorproject.org. They ask, I'd love to hear Andrew's take on the relative value of corporate counsel. Is an $800 per hour attorney with a $450 an hour associate fee really worth that much more than a $450 an hour attorney with a $200 associate fee, especially when you're not involved in any litigation, maybe just creating somewhat boilerplate documents, filing for trademarks, incorporating, etc. I get that there are certain critical things that require the best that you can afford, but it feels like a bit like you're essentially paying insurance for a higher priced firm when you may not really need to.
Well, Sparkle Donkey Tequila, like, I don't know if you if you planted that question just like so I could do an advertisement for my firm, but that's like essentially what I do, right? In my day job, I still litigate a handful of cases, but by and large, what I am is outsourced general counsel to small businesses who are kind of stuck in this place where if most lawyers with kind of a big firm background, right, are ridiculously expensive. Yeah, you say $800 an hour. My buddy Eric Holder at Covington is billing out at $2,000 an hour. And associates – first year associates at Covington and Burling are, I think he said $800 in his, I mean, like, and so, yeah, like it gets to a point where, you know, we had a couple of clients and, you know, God bless them. Like, I'll give you this. If you are, if you have a company and you are using, you know, a Covington and Burling, type big law firm, and you're comfortable with that, you can say to them like, hey, I don't want any first through third years on my cases. You know nothing that first year out of law school. And I certainly would not pay $800 an hour. That's way more than I charge, for somebody that doesn't know a goddamn thing. And, you know, and as you point out, there are a lot of things, in corporate law that are, you know, reasonably boilerplate. You want a level of, you want a level of investment higher than using LegalZoom. You don't just want to go on and Google and do a search and replace for documents you find online. So you do want like high end judgment, but you shouldn't also have to pay, exorbitant rates for that person to, you know, draft you a non-disclosure agreement or what have you. That's a plug for my firm. Thank you, Sparkle Donkey Tequila. That's what we try and do is give that kind of big firm value add at not that price.
All right, here we go. T3B related one from Jeff Jackson.
Ooh.
Why not start Thomas off with a new score? If there's a standard number of questions on the bar exam, let Thomas do that number of questions and see if he passes. If he doesn't, he can retake the test starting at zero. If you fail the bar in real life, your previous score doesn't count against you in your next attempt, which I feel is happening to Thomas. Well, it's actually the opposite. My previous good score is the only thing keeping my percentage still in the 50s. Because is it 200? What's the normal?
Yeah, I mean, So the answer is we're kind of doing that, right?
Kind of doing that. So here's what happened, Jeff Jackson, if you're listening. The first 200, reasonable test. I did okay. I got what, 54? What did I end up at? 50? Not quite 55, I think. Or was I? What was I for the first 200?
Does anyone remember? It was right around 54, 55%. Yeah.
And then the subsequent 20, 30 questions have been impossible, and then getting like a zero. So, yeah. So if anything, that I need that, I need that first 200 questions to bolster my percentage. But yeah, no, I like that. Once we calibrate where we are on the practice tests and we find a non-porked one, maybe we take that on. Okay. Let's get to another one here. Drew Vogel. Second question from Drew Vogel. But I'm looking at the hearts and they're good. It's a meritocracy here. Are there any restrictions on the arguments jurors can make to one another? I know judges are supposed to consider only the merits of the argument presented and those presented and passed in similar cases. Can a juror bring in their own personal experience to the deliberations? E.g., could Mona Lisa Vito have used her same knowledge of tire tracks and positraction in jury deliberations if neither party brought up tire tracks in their arguments? If jurors can make arguments based on something other than what has been presented, are there any controls to prevent bullshitters from just sowing chaos? Interesting question.
So the answer is, in general, the court will not invade the sovereignty of the jury box. So and what that means is yes, they can bring up personal experience. And this is really consistent with the whole idea of, you know, being tried by a jury of your peers, right? Like they're supposed to bring their life experience into figuring out, like, you know, is that guy telling the truth or not? And that's why you have 12 too, right? So that, you know, it's not just one guy like, well, you know, brown people are never telling the truth, right? Like you've got to say that in a room with 12 other people and hopefully,
I've never thought about this though. Like what if for some reason there's expert witness during a trial and then someone in the jury voir dire didn't clear this. Just happens to be an expert on that thing and is like, look, this guy was kind of full of shit. I'm an expert at whatever. Here's my take. Is there anything to stop that? Or is it just, you know, it is what it is.
So that's a great sub question. And in that situation, what you would do, this dovetails with the question at the end of like, you know, how do you check against like somebody who's just sowing chaos? And the answer is you send a question back to the judge. Right. And you say, hey, is it possible to do, for somebody to cast doubt on an expert opinion with their own personal experience or something like that? And the judge will give you an instruction based upon that. Yeah, I see. You've got
55.5% Tagum says.
That's beautiful.
Also, I want to send a note to the judge that's like, will you go out with me, Y/N, and then see what happens.
I will
get thrown off the jury.
I will tell you, a lawyer friend of mine tells the story of serving on a jury and it being a very clear case, right? It was a criminal rape conviction, and the one holdout was saying, well, the testimony, let me give this is a mild content warning. I'm going to describe a particular encounter here. So come back in 30 seconds or skip ahead if you're listening to the audio. But the testimony was that the man had pushed the woman up against the wall and raped her. And one of the elderly people on the jury said, well, you can't possibly have sex standing up, so I'm going to vote to acquit. And two of the jurors proceeded, I don't know in how much detail the story has been told to me over alcohol, but you know, proceeded to demonstrate to the sufficiency of the 12th juror that yes, indeed, you can have sex in a standing position. So that's wow. That's immediately what my mind goes to. I apologize for the.
You ever think like the whole justice system is crap because we have to get 12 people who may not know you can have sex standing up?
That's part of why that story has made the rounds, you know, by lawyers. So
yikes. Okay. Here's one that I am confident that you've told me before, but I still don't remember and I need to know. Spinoza's Godzilla asks, is there really someone who sketches a picture of the courtroom during a trial? Well, they say trail, but I think they mean trial. If so, why? Is there a reason they haven't switched to photography? Has your likeness been captured on one? Oh, that's a great follow-up, too. Simultaneously, every time we're watching a crime show, inevitably, they've got the courtroom sketches. And I have two thoughts. I'm like, A, why the fuck are they still doing that? And then B, I'm glad they're still doing it because they're always great. I love looking at them. Like, is this like a PBS thing? Like, we're sponsoring artists, you know, like the arts? Is that like we're just making this still have to exist, that even though it definitely doesn't need to?
So first, I want to profess my ignorance as to why it is still a practice, given that most courtrooms do allow cameras. I suspect the answer is just habit from when they did not. I will also tell you that one of my old partners at Zuckerman Spader was the head lawyer in a very prominent trial and has the courtroom sketch of his oral argument, right? You know, what the courtroom sketch artist drew, framed in his office, which I always thought was super duper cool. So I have never been captured by a courtroom artist. I do not know. I wonder
if they take commissions.
Yeah.
What if you could be like, hey, on your own time, can you draw one of me just fucking winning the hell out of this case? Just like, you know, and then like the jury's like weeping in the background. They're just like, oh, it's such a great speech, closing argument he gave, you know. I wonder if they do that.
Can you like Brad Pitt me up about 30%?
There's one that
there,
just does the caricatures of everybody. That'd be funny too.
Oh my god, like the beach. That would be fantastic. I don't recall giving that oral argument while eating an oversized sandwich.
Okay. Well, you know, it's a little early, but just no. 13 minutes is good for lightning round. What do you think? I'm gonna go down to the bottom.
Okay.
So I'm getting the question. In fact, this may take a second. I'm even going to refresh the thread, which may mess up my zooming stuff. Hold on. Let me see. Okay. So I'm getting up to the minute questions, I guess.
Paul Duggan in the YouTube live chat says, we should hire a courtroom caricature artist for live shows.
That's the best idea I've ever heard in my life. That is okay. Right. Somebody write that. Hold on. I actually have a note that was back when we had a world. Remember that? I had a note for live shows that was like, you know, ideas for stuff we're going to do. Here it is. Oh my God. This is Paul. That is, you are a fucking genius. Okay. Here we go. I'm wasting no time. Hire courtroom sketch artist. Bam. It's in the notebook. That is an incredible idea. Okay, everybody forget so that later I can pretend it was my... No, I'm just kidding. I would never do that. So, we're going from the bottom now. This is the lightning round, so I'm not using a heart-based system. This is as fast as I can vet them. Let's see. I'm going to take one. You got a Transformers one, so I'm taking this one.
Okay.
David Bax, Spino Breaker, asks, Magic the Gathering question, what do you prefer, milling out your opponent or using an infection token to take them down? Well, I will tell you, when I first got into playing Magic in any sort of, like, any sort of competitive ways, i.e. like Friday Night Magic and trying to do well at it. It was right when Infect came out in Scars of Mirrodin. Is that what it was? And those sets were so good. I fucking love those sets. And I made up a homebrew, just an Infection deck, which at the time was really good. But the problem was that was also right when Cobblade was dominant and was the most impossible deck in the history of Magic. And until they finally tried to do some bannings to get rid of it. So I would win at a Friday Night Magic level with my brew, with my Infect brew. But I couldn't. But anyway, I will say, though, I also won a decently big sized tournament with a mill control deck. Back in the day, I won like $400 and an invite to, I think it was a TCG qualifier. So it was pretty cool. And so that one has a special place in my heart, too. It was a control deck with kind of the mill win condition, which means you get rid of the entire opponent's library. And then once they're out of cards, they lose, essentially, Andrew, without trying to break it down too much. So I guess I got to say, Infect was really fun when I first started playing. And then milling was what I actually won with, a mill control deck. So. See, that's the same reaction I had during your Transformers stuff. Exactly the same.
I love that you are passionate about a totally geeky thing.
Yeah, I don't play anymore. I can't keep up with it, but maybe someday. I always feel like someday I could get back into that. It's a lot of fun. I might get back into cubing if I can find people to cube with. That'd be fun. Okay, back to the questions. Here we go. What? We've kind of talked about this before, so we can try to answer this. General contact unit problem child. What if instead of having a set number of 9 and doing one in one out as they die or retire, every president was just allowed to appoint one Supreme Court justice per term? I think that's been on the table, right?
Yeah. It is far less important to me. And I hope this comes through in our originalism episodes. The number is important because of how fucked our Supreme Court is right now. The problem is, right, coming up with strategies that don't depend on no Republican will ever get elected again, right? Like, because what we have not successfully done is made the case to the American public as to why it's bad, right? Like, and when I talk to, like, just your average, ordinary people about the Supreme Court, right, their take on it is, and the way that Democrats have framed it, they're either sympathetic or not, right, is, yeah, well, right, Democrats are in power and they put liberals on the Supreme Court. Republicans are in power and they put conservatives on the Supreme Court. And, you know, yeah, I get it that, like, you know, Mitch McConnell stole a Supreme Court seat from Barack Obama. But, you know, the Democrats probably would have done that, too, if they could have. Now, almost everything is wrong with that assessment. But to me, the thing that's the most wrong about it is the idea that what we object to is that Neil Gorsuch is conservative, right? Is that, you know, somehow you're not entitled to put somebody who shares your beliefs on the Supreme Court. And like, that's just not true. Like, I am trying to come up with the best way, and, like, Lord knows I'm not the best person to be doing this, but to go out and kind of fight that disinformation war, right? It's why we did those two episodes.
It's hard because you can't separate – you can't forget about the fact that we have the stupid fucking Electoral College. So therefore, these people have been appointed by somebody who has lost the popular vote in what? What is it? 4 out of 5? Whatever it is. And like – the problem is it makes us turn into kind of whiny people who are like, oh, this isn't fair. And then they can point to the letter of the law and be like, well, it's all fair. It's all the rules. These are all the rules. But it's like, yeah, you've been benefiting unfairly by these shitty rules set up 250 years ago that don't make sense anymore. And so it's hard to separate it from that. That's why I just think we should just admit it's a political thing and we should just try to stack the court if we could. But I don't know. Yeah, people don't agree with me on that.
I don't agree with you on that. But I want to make the strongest argument in support of your position is that, you know, is to take a look at the population and to say, like, yeah, well, in general, like, just over half, right? Just over 50% of the population agrees with kind of the center left to left position. And so if you just said, hey, let's get a Supreme Court that looks more like America, that would be a much more liberal Supreme Court. It obviously that's not my philosophy, but I think that you shouldn't undersell, like, I think that your position should not be dismissed like that cavalierly to say like, well, you know, like it at some point, right, our institutions ought to reflect the population from which they come. Like, that would be my argument in support of your argument.
Well, I guess what's frustrating is they get to do the thing where they pretend that what the Supreme Court is doing is protecting some sort of institutional, whatever, traditional something. And all it's doing is giving them an unfair way to enforce minority rule on us. That's all it's doing. And there's nothing holy about that. It's just an advantage they have to enforce stuff that the majority of people don't want on the majority.
It used to be the case. And I mean, when I say it used to be the case, I mean, when I was in law school, right? Like the left versus right debate was, and I have alluded to this before, you know, the footnote 4 from the Caroline Products decision, which is from like 1917, right? Like, and it basically says that the Supreme Court has, it's not just like, that they should be, it's not just they shouldn't be following the, long dead wishes of the founding fathers, but rather that the Supreme Court was designed from the outset to be the branch of government that could care the most about minority rights, and particularly discrete and insular minorities are the words that are used in Caroline Products, because that's why they're not elected. That's why they get to serve for life. So the idea was they're the most insulated. They don't have to pander to the majority. So they ought to be sticking up for, you know, the most disenfranchised in society. It's a really great argument.
Exact opposite. Yeah, it is. Except what's happened is there's a political minority that now their will is to screw over, you know, ethnic minorities and other kinds of minorities, and they're using this institution. So it's a real slap in the face to talk about minority rights as a, you know, in that way. But let's get to another. This was a really cool question. I love this one. Stormy Decisis, who else? This is like a twist on the recent, you know, your client is lying questions. You're representing a client who plans to plead out, but you come to know that the client is lying about their guilt, such as, you know, the client's brother committed the crime and the client is taking the fall. How does the lawyer's responsibility not to be complicit in perjury play out there? So it's kind of the mirror image of that. Like, what if you have a guilt, a client you know is innocent and they are pleading guilty, for example?
I love that question. I was actually involved in a case that was sort of adjacent to that question, right? So I've mentioned my limited criminal law experience comes from being an eighth year associate, like right on the cusp of partnership and sort of, you know, getting to know a lot of different partners by helping them out in cases. And this was a case in which it was a corporate case. It involved a distributor that had signed off on certain audits and had just like, it was just like paperwork that came across his desk, and he was like, and he called up somebody else in the company and was like, what do I do with this? And they were like, it was an audit for a third party, and he called up that third party and said, what do I do with this? And they were like, hey, you just sign it. It's just lawyer paperwork for the lawyers, right? Like, and my guy was a sophisticated business person, had been in his niche industry for a very long time, but, you know, high school degree, right? Like not a lawyer. And as it turned out, like that was tax fraud. And so he was supposed to be verifying to the independent auditors these numbers. And instead, he was just like, yeah, you know, he called them up and they were like, just whatever. It's just a law thing. Just sign off on it. Right. And now, mind you, like, again, super stupid thing to do. So he knew he was going to be in trouble when everything came out. And he got a very, very favorable plea deal on the basis of us going to the prosecutor and basically telling that story. I mean, like, yeah, we get it, but, like, you know, this is not fucking Bernie Madoff, right? Like, this is a guy who made a dumb mistake. And so they offered him a great plea deal, but the problem was that the lesser offense that they offered him required him, and I'm trying, I don't want to give away too much of the facts, because I don't have his permission to talk about it. But the offense to which they were willing to let him plead, in order to plead out, you have to allocute, right? You have to, to say to the judge, I understand and I am guilty of the crime to which, I am pleading. And there was an element in that lesser crime that he was clearly not guilty of.
Oh, wow.
And we had to fight for, and he would not say it. And, you know, on, I mean, it made me feel really great about the representation, sort of the, it's a little adjacent to these questions. But, you know, I mean, nobody in the room said, like, come on, man, just like say, like, this is a super great deal. We got you.
Yeah.
Who, you know, that just use your nice, cheap words, right? Like, there was maybe a little thought of that. But I really respected the fact that he was like, I don't care how great the deal is. You want me to say on the record under oath that I did X thing and I did not do X thing.
Yeah.
And ultimately, we were able to get, an accommodation that made everybody happy. So the answer to that is that there is a potential complicity in that situation if you know in the allocution that you're going to be suborning perjury. As a practical matter, I suspect that most lawyers would just overlook that. But I love the question. Great. I mean,
yeah.
Stormy always asks us great questions. So.
Yeah. I love the kind of the inverse situation there. It's interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're out of time, but why don't we squeeze in one more quick, this is not going to be a rapid fire, but rapidly as you can. General Contact Union Problem Child asks, suppose Warren or Bernie were the president instead of Biden, could they get Medicare for All passed with budget reconciliation? That's a tough question to answer in 2 seconds.
Yeah. And so the answer is not in any permanent way, right? Mm. Budget reconciliation, it has to – I mean, we went through all of the different requirements in the reconciliation
process. Yeah, only for 10 years at most,
but that's
right?
The biggest one is, right, it would phase out at the end of 10 years. And so if you're comfortable with that – see, the difference is, right, like Republicans have used reconciliation to cram through tax cuts. And the reason is that they know that when those tax cuts are set to expire, if a Republican's in office, that they'll extend them.
Yeah.
If a Democrat's in office, they'll be like, really? You're going to – Raise taxes on them. Right. And so,
not to mention, they and their corporate buddies can just make a bunch of money for 10 years. Like, in worst case, they make way more, you know, keep way more money for 10 years.
Yep. And so, but think about it, that threat does not work in reverse for healthcare, right? Like, if Obamacare was scheduled to expire, let's see, I mean, that this would be the year, right? Like, if it would have expired at the end of 2020, right? Like, Republicans would have been cheering in the streets, right? Like, it would not have been a, really? You're going to let this expire? They would have been like, yep. And think about, like, what an unbelievable disruption to the system that would be to, like, you know, put because, you know, Obamacare started to show this, but like the way in which universal healthcare works is you have to pool risks, right? And that means you have to take people who are 30 years old, who are in good shape with no pre-existing conditions, who exercise frequently, and you got to put them in a pool with your chain-smoking Uncle Carl. And like if you have a time limit on that, then like, then those 30-year-olds have just gotten screwed, right? If it works forever, then, you know, you're buying into a system that you'll be a part of, you know, when you're 60 and chain smoking and, you know, but if you never get
there.
I don't know.
255, I don't know if that's true. I mean, think about the Violence Against Women Act. Didn't they let that expire or did they what was the deal with that?
Yeah,
they let that expire, I think.
Yep.
And that would be something where it's like literally the Violence Against Women Act. You're going to let that expire rather than do anything about it. And apparently Republicans are like, sure.
They have campaigned on repeal Obamacare since 2010.
Yeah.
So, you know, I get it. I mean, 255 is saying like, well, you know, Social Security is entrenched now. But like Social Security isn't that entrenched, right? Like it as recently as 2005, you know, the last slightly sane Republican president we had was like, well, let's, you know, begin phasing out Social Security. So like, I think you're way optimistic that is the case.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. As usual, that was a ton of fun. Thanks for the great questions. Andrew put another hole in his wall. You just can't see it. He doesn't, you know. He's learned to punch holes in the wall off camera.
I have to, just to record for anybody who listens to this, Stormy Decisis will give them the last word, who says, I mean, it should have been called the Anti-Violence Against Women Act, which is pretty funny. So
fair enough. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much for watching, everybody. We love you so much, patrons and non-patrons alike, and we will see you next time.
Bye-bye.